morning and welcome to the second day of our October term held here at Black Hills State University. The court would like to welcome students from the university, Bison High School, Douglas High School, and Rapid City Christian High School. We have three publications available in the lobby if you are interested. Just help yourself. The first one, the light brown cover, tan covered book, gives you a short summary of the 9 oral argument cases we will be hearing this term. Also tells you a little bit about us and the Supreme Court, how it operates. The second booklet, the blue covered one, is a written narrative on how both the trial courts work in South Dakota and the Supreme Court. And the third one is a pictorial directory of our history, if you will, of the South Dakota Supreme Court. And page 24, we have a picture of our last visit to Black Hills State in 1999, of a photograph of some students taken there. I would point out also that if you are interested in these cases you hear this morning, not only are they live on the internet and archived, but when the decisions are issued by this court, they are also posted on that internet webpage within 24 hours of issuance. And the website is available on the back cover of the synopsis of the cases. The first case for oral argument this morning is Stephen Lee Tosh, appellant versus Kenneth Schwab, et al., appellees. For the appellant is Mr. Drew Johnson, an attorney from Aberdeen. And for the appellee is Mr. Jack Heap, an attorney also from Aberdeen. Mr. Johnson, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to preface my comments this morning by stating to the court that there are 7 issues addressed in my brief. I probably won't have time to address all 7, depending on the interaction we have with the court, but they're all important, and I trust that you will seriously consider all of them and apply them appropriately to this case. This is a case that probably is best summarized by the expert testimony of the defense witness, Dennis Waller, who stated at trial that my client, Stephen Lee Tosh, was a very fortunate individual, that he wasn't arrested and convicted because the officers thought there was enough evidence to go that way and actually get that job done. But this case really comes down to what is police, the proper police conduct in a case like this when they have a suspect and how far can they go to try to make their case. They think or thought at the time that the child rape case took place on July 3rd of 1998 that Steve Tosh was in a group of individuals that would be a suspect. They thought that because he grew up in the house where this young girl lived, which was really no fault of Steve's at all because that's where his parent, his mother, lived at the time. They also thought that he had some interest in the house both before and after the child kidnap and rape case took place because he'd repeatedly go over to that area and check on this house.
Well, he also claimed that he had gone into the house after he had moved out to do his laundry. Hadn't he told someone that, too, that he had snuck into the house or broke in?
Judge, the evidence at the trial showed that in 1997, when the house was sold, he was still living there, and he did move out, and I think it was in August of 1997 when it was still vacant. He did go back to the house to use the laundry facilities, but the family moved in later that fall that eventually bought this house, and Steve Tosh, and there was no evidence to show it, ever went back to that house after that time, which I think is an important part of the evidence that the officers were missing because there was some indication that my client would know the layout of the house, but by the time that he moved out and the family moved in, there was a whole year that took place before any activity of a criminal nature took place there.
Was there another fact, too, though, that I thought, too, that there was evidence that he, or at least one of his friends, had said that he had fantasized about or spoke about raping little girls, too, and that got to the police, too.
I believe you're referring to an individual by the name of David Blue. that was interviewed by the police, and in fact, I think he was a very cooperative individual. Although he never testified at the trial, his name was certainly mentioned. It should be mentioned here that there was a $10,000 reward. I believe that was the amount that was offered by the police department later on in the case because they were going nowhere with it, and they needed some evidence. And that may have been the reason why this David Liu came up with these statements. So keep in mind that Steve Tosh denied making those statements, or if he made anything similar to those statements, he actually was just joking, and David Liu even indicated that in one of his interviews, that he thought that Steve Tosh wouldn't have done that type of crime, and what he was saying about raping girls was done in jest. It should be kept in mind that Steve Tosh had a clean criminal record except for some check charges that came out of a gambling addiction that he had, and that was aftermath of what got him into trouble and eventually put him in jail when all of this police investigation was going on about the rape case. But Steve Tosh also had a chronic depression problem before this incident, and he was on a certain type of medication that actually made him impotent. The officers knew that, knew that he wouldn't have those types of sexual desires or ability to carry it out if he would want to. And that was a big piece of the evidence that I think if there was a trial against Steve Tosh at some time would have certainly come out of this case. But I think all of the evidence they were using against him to stage or justify their approach to him in this investigation was equally outweighed or was offset by other facts that I've just mentioned that would show that perhaps he wasn't the real suspect. And, of course, as it further developed, the nuclear DNA test came back from a number of individuals, and they did find another individual who was eventually arrested, convicted, sent to prison, and he committed suicide about 2 weeks down at the state pen. But at that time is when Steve Tosh came to me for assistance. When this became known, I received a phone call from a person, a male voice, that indicated that the police department was out to get Steve Tosh. That was their whole agenda.
Is this in the record?
Yes, it is. Okay. It's in the affidavit of Steve Tosh that was in a reply to a summary judgment motion by the defendants, where he did indicate that through my involvement, we received the phone call indicating the holes were drilled in the taillight, and I should check into that. And up till that time, I didn't know that, but we had the car come out, brought out to my office by Steve Tosh to check that out. In fact, that did occur. One of the interviews that he had early on in my case, he told me the officers were following him also in this 24/7 surveillance. And he told me this story, and I was in disbelief. I couldn't believe it. I looked out my office window, and sure enough, there was a police car parked out in front of my office. And as soon as my conference with my client was done, he left, and the police officer left right behind him. But I'll get into more details on that 24/7 surveillance in a minute. But it comes down to the conviction of another individual for the crime, and that, of course, settled any issue about Steve Tosh being involved. And that's where I thought it was appropriate to challenge these officers and what they did. The first issue or cause of action I could think of was the intentional infliction of emotional distress that they brought to bear on Steve Tosh. To prove that, at least one of the elements you have to show in that case type of action is extreme and outrageous conduct. I hired an expert, at least I thought he was an expert, Dr. John Game, perhaps you've heard of him, from the University of South Dakota. At least in my opinion, he had an impressive resume, a Kirkland Vitae, if you will, that did put him into the category of an expert.
Did he have a law enforcement background?
He was not an officer, did not wear a badge. When you say a background in law enforcement, he had read the same books that the defendant's expert read, especially on interrogations, the Imbal Reid technique of interrogations. He read all of those. He was aware of those. In fact, he even mentions those in his first report to me about those types of techniques that could or could not be used. So he was well aware of that. The difference being, I guess, with the trial judge is that he was not a person that had previously worn a badge, and that's how the court, I think the trial court differentiated between Dennis Waller, the defense expert, and John Game, because he was not an officer. And I don't believe that is the touchstone, if I can use the phrase, of this court in the case on the Daubert-type qualifications.
Well, when I read his the trial court judge's memorandum decision here, one of the things that he relies on to not allow your expert is that he did not have expertise in police procedure in conducting surveillance and interrogations.
Judge, so, the expertise that he didn't have was the actual experience as an officer in the past. He didn't have that, but he had the training. He self-studied. He read all of the articles and the publications put out in law enforcement, the same as Dennis Waller did.
And did they involve surveillance and interrogations?
Sure, absolutely. The Imbal Reed publication has been out for 30-some years, and that's the benchmark, I think, of what you base your interrogations on in a case like this and how to do it. And he's well aware of that. And as I indicated, he even mentions using that in coming up with his opinion, his written opinion, that what was done here was not a proper.
You don't become an expert in an area just by reading the definitive work in the area of interrogation. You can't become an expert just by that. And as Justice Meyer Henry pointed out, the trial court found he didn't have much experience in surveillance and interrogation. And I noticed when I read his CV and other materials, he was really more involved in corrections and treatment. That seemed to be the whole focus of his professional life. So how would that be an abuse of discretion? We don't get to second-guess the trial court and everything. This is an abuse of discretion.
I understand that, Judge. And I was going to refer to Justice Meyer Henry's comments about his background, and I think in doing so I'll address your question too. The Burley versus Kitek case, which this court just decided in August of this year, and which I filed a supplemental brief to get before the court, the trial court there found that the professor at the University of South Dakota that was used as the plaintiff's expert hadn't been an expert before in a case of that nature, judging what is a proper label or a warning on a certain type of product. But this court said, and I quote, whether or not a person has been an expert before in that particular field, quote, it's a poor touchstone for measuring genuine expert qualifications, end quote. So I don't believe you have to be an officer in the past to be somebody that can give an expert opinion about what officers should or should not do.
That was about, you know, whether he was a professional witness and had testified before. I mean, if I read a book on military strategy, does that make me an expert in military strategy? I think, you know, just reading a book wouldn't be enough. I mean, especially in law enforcement, it's the doing that makes you an expert. And in the case you're citing there, this professor at USD, in Burley versus Kitek, had done a lot of his own experimenting with things, whereas, you, as I understand, your expert is saying I'm an expert because I read some books about it. Doesn't that make a difference to you?
The judge, also, the Burley case, I think, answers that question. If you recall, that was much of the background information that Dr. Burkhout had, the professor at USD, in that case, was by self-learning or being self-taught by reading a lot of things. And this court notes that by doing that, you can, in fact, acquire the expert knowledge that you need to give an expert opinion. You don't have to be one to be an expert about one. And I believe that's where it's at. I think it's similar, and I use this illustration in my brief, using a chemist in a medical malpractice case. And the defendant doctor would object to the chemist being declared an expert because he wasn't a doctor. But the chemist would certainly have all the knowledge that he needs to be an expert in some type of a prescription drug that perhaps would not have been prescribe. And you shouldn't keep him out of court because he hasn't been a doctor. Same here. You shouldn't keep Dr. Game away from being an expert because he hasn't been a police officer. And I believe that's, at least I'm seeing this, and it's a concern of mine, that we're going too far in this direction of the Daubert challenges and keeping too much of this type of evidence out. You recognize that in that Burley case. You recognize that in the First Western Bank of Wall case, where you say a lot of these questions about the credibility should be challenges made at the trial level. In fact, the quote that I wrote down here from Burley is, deficiencies in the qualifications can be tested through the adversary process at trial, end quote. And that's where this case should have gone with Dr. Game. Let them cross-examine him, bring up all these deficiencies allegedly, and let the jury decide if he is qualified to give that type of expert opinion. And I think the jury would have believed him because he was, in fact, involved in police work through his training that he's mentioned in his curriculum vitae, also in his affidavit. It's important to read his affidavit, and a copy of that is attached to my first brief.
Since you weren't allowed to present his opinion, did that evidence come in by anybody else's opinion?
It did not, Judge. One of the elements, the first element of an IED claim, if I could use that abbreviation, is to show extreme and outrageous conduct. When I couldn't show that through his testimony, and he clearly stated in his report that what he saw and what the officers were doing, both because of the surveillance and the type of interrogations that were being used, where they were telling my client to kill himself, that was an extreme and outrageous conduct. But when the judge took that expert away from me, and another issue I have is not being able to replace him with another expert, I wasn't able to forcefully persuade the jury that the IIED claim was provable at trial because I didn't have that first step.
So the jury never heard anything about the surveillance at all?
Pardon me?
Did the jury hear anything about all the surveillance?
No.
Not a thing?
If there were mentions made of the surveillance that took place, it was only in passing.
Okay.
There was a motion in limine made that kept any evidence about the 24/7 surveillance in any detail, at least, away from the jury.
What about the jury? You mentioned just a minute ago that the officers suggested to your client that he kill himself. Did they admit that, or is that, how did that, was that only your client saying that, or did the officers say something?
Two of the officers, Schwab and Pionk, use that type of language. In one of the very first meetings that my client had with the lead officer or the chief of police with Schwab was when he went in to complain about what they were doing to him on this 24/7 surveillance. He did not like that, contrary to what the officers may have said, that they thought he enjoyed it. But he went in to complain, forcibly complain, about being tailed all over town like he was followed.
And did the officers
at one of those interviews, my client said that Officer Schwab told him that we don't care what you think, we're going to keep up with the surveillance, it's only going to get worse from here on out, and if you don't like it, you can go kill yourself. Now, that was never denied by the chief of police at the trial. Never once did he mention that he never said that. It's in the record from Steve Tosh having him said that. That was only the one interview that wasn't taped between the officers and my client. All the other ones were taped. Officer Pionk admitted when he told my client in one of his interrogations, if I would have done what you've done, I couldn't live with myself. I asked him on cross-examination if that was a direct reference to suicide, and he admitted that it was. So there is ample evidence in the record that was.
Let me ask you about your pleadings for a minute. Did you allege a separate cause of action for intentional infliction of emotional distress just for the surveillance and then a separate cause of action for something else? So I'm curious why you wouldn't want it all in one cause of action. Were you expecting to get separate damages for each one, or what was your strategy there?
I'll stand corrected. Based on my pleadings, I can't honestly answer that right now. If it's actually two different causes of action by number, or if it's one cause of action that bases it on the surveillance and the types of interrogations. But at a pretrial summary judgment motion hearing, the trial judge ruled that the 24/7 surveillance was not proven to be.
So that just took out your separate cause of action, and then it left us another cause of action for the other conduct besides the surveillance. I'm curious to why you would put them, you'd separate them into, you know, when it's all part of one thing. Why would you separate it into two?
I don't think it was a trial strategy to separate the two. I think that's the way it was presented to the trial court at the summary judgment hearing, and he bifurcated them to challenge the surveillance on the one hand, and he said that wasn't extreme and outrageous, and I had no evidence to prove it because by that time I didn't have my expert available.
But you say he bifurcated them, but did your complaint have two separate causes of action?
I think it was, Judge, set out in two different ways, alleging both. But because I couldn't go forward on the surveillance issue, then what was left was to go to court on the IID claim because of the interrogations, which the judge himself found if those comments were made about killing the defendant or the defendant, Tosh, that would be extreme and outrageous. I would like to get to a second issue that deals with this Daubert challenge to my witness, is the fact that I tried to get the amended scheduling order put in place that would allow me to come in with another expert. We did not have a trial date set. In fact, from the time that my motion was made until we actually had the trial, it was 20 months later, or almost 2 years later. We would have had ample time to bring in another expert.
When was the trial date set? And how did that get set? Apparently after the denial of your request to amend so you could get a new expert.
That's right.
At some point after that, the trial date was set.
It was.
How much later?
There was no trial date set as of the date my motion to amend the scheduling order was filed. Everything else was put in place. The reason I needed to amend the scheduling order because we had a deadline to disclose the experts. Well, that had come and gone. Well, when the trial judge took my expert away from me, I tried to get the order amended so I'd have time to bring in another expert. And that was denied, and that's why I think this is an important issue for the court, which I think is a case of first impression, can decide for all of us practitioners, when do you know your expert is not going to be allowed to testify at trial, and what is the procedure to get him replaced? What should we do out there in finding these experts? Because I was, and I based my motion on total surprise, where my expert wasn't going to be able to testify.
Your time has expired, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Eve, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I would like to start with the point where Mr. Johnson left off, and that relates to the Dr. Gem's testimony. I would agree with Mr. Johnson to the extent that I don't think this court has stated that there's some bright line that an expert needs to cross in order to be an expert. In fact, the rules are pretty clear, and this court's recent decisions are pretty clear, that you can get to be an expert by more than one way. I mean, you can do it through experience, you can do it through training, you can do it through some combination of the two. And the thing that I think is important about whether or not an expert is allowed to get up in front of a jury, it goes to whether or not they're going to do any good, whether they're going to harm the process or help the process. Because the purpose behind an expert is they're supposed to get up on the stand and help the jury figure something out that's beyond, I think the word that's been used is the ken of the average layman, beyond the understanding of the average layperson. And so when I went and deposed Dr. Gem, the questions that I asked him were directed toward that. What information are you going to give the jury that's going to help them understand what my clients did that was improper? And he couldn't answer that question. He wouldn't answer that question. We went around and around and around, and that deposition transcript is in the record, and I'm sure you've had a chance to review it. But the simple question I asked him was, what is the standard of care? You've got two issues here, and I think it was really Dr. Gem who, in his expert report, was looking at the surveillance and the interrogations, and he was saying these are something you'd see in a police state. And my own expert who I consulted with had said, no, it's something you'd see in the textbooks. It's classic Imbaugh and Reed. The interrogation, if you watch these videotapes, what you're seeing, the interaction between Lunsman and Pionk, And this suspect is exactly what they teach in that course.
They tell people that if you do something like, if I had done something like this, you ought to go out and commit suicide?
And
that's classic textbook work.
And to answer that question, Your Honor, my clients have adamantly stated they never said that. And in fact, that was put in an affidavit by Stephen Tosh. And Mr. Johnson, in order to get past summary judgment, put that affidavit in front of the court. And if the court looks at the record and looks at the decision of the trial judge even stated, had I had those videotapes to review at the time I ruled on summary judgment, this case may not have gotten that far. Your Honor, this was all videotaped. Every bit of this was videotaped, with the exception of the very first Schwab interview. And I'll get to that in a minute. But the things that he's claiming my client said, every split second, and this isn't denied by Mr. Tosh, every split second of that was on videotape with audio. And I defy anyone to tell me that who's watched that videotape in its entirety where Stephen Pionk ever said, you ought to go kill yourself. What he said, and he admitted to it at trial, was in the process of playing on what is guilt that defendants often have for committing a heinous crime. And Detective Pionk, this is classic Reed Nimbaugh, was to go to guilt and say, you know, if I had done something like that, I'm not sure that I could live with myself, as part of trying to draw him out. It was the same comments that were made playing on religion, which is classic Reed Nimbaugh. Stephen Tosh's mother had passed away, and in order, and Stephen Tosh had indicated a belief in God, a belief in heaven. One of the things that they're taught in that interrogation is to play on the notion that you have loved ones in heaven. If you want to see them, you need to tell the truth. You need to come clean. You need to tell us what really happened. That's what it was. But the context of it, Your Honor, was never, why don't you go out and kill yourself? And in fact, yes, they did know he was suicidal. What was interesting about it was, with regard to the surveillance, the reason that we know they knew he was suicidal is because Dave Lunsman specifically told the officers doing the surveillance, watch this guy closely. He has been put into institutions in the past with threats of suicide. And the reason they did that was to keep him from committing suicide. They knew that he was under pressure, but they also knew, given the chain of evidence that existed here, that he could very well have been the person who perpetrated this crime.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes,
about
sure.
The experts again. What was different about your expert and the opinions they gave on the interrogation techniques that you're talking about here, plaintiffs in this case? What was the difference in the two experts? That one got in and one didn't, because they both were using the same. I'll just say this: part of the Daubert is to keep out junk science. If they were both relying upon the same treatises or the same writings and the same general body of information about interrogations, why is one okay and one not?
And I think that is the crux of why one got in and one didn't. The question I think that bothered the trial judge the most in this case, and the response that Dr. Gem gave to it, was when I finally fleshed out from Dr. Gem at his deposition, what treatises are you relying on? He hits Reed and Imbaugh. He talks about Reed and Imbaugh, which is what everybody agrees is the standard for interrogations. And we start talking about Reed and Imbaugh, and he comes out and essentially says, I don't agree with it. It's the standard, but I don't agree with it. And I said, well, isn't it generally accepted within the law enforcement community that this is the standard that you use? And he said it, you know, yeah, because they're not as concerned about false confessions as I am. But I think it's something that's evolving. And that's what Judge Flemmer really touched upon, was his concern about this being basically junk science. That opinion was not generally accepted, it was not peer-reviewed, and there was certainly no statistical evidence that he could point to back it up. It was simply his opinion as somebody who didn't like what he viewed law enforcement as doing here. And the other thing that I'll point out about these
interrogations... You don't think it would have gotten under Fry either?
I don't, Your Honor, and as we know, that the Fry test is still part of the Daubert test. It can't be overemphasized, but it's still part of it. And I think it's a concern because what my clients did, and I'm going to go back to it, they videotaped every bit of this. I mean, there are no secrets about what they did. And when you watch the videotape, you don't find the things that Mr. Tosh put into his affidavit. They're not there. And that's what the jury got to see. The jury wasn't looking at an affidavit. The jury actually sat and watched those portions of those videotapes that Mr. Johnson decided to play for them. I didn't object to any of it. He didn't play all of them. We'd still be there, you know, in some ways. He played the parts he thought were important. And there was nothing heinous or ridiculous about it. The other thing that I'll say about this is he was never kept against his will. Every single one of those interviews started on the record with either Lunsman or Pionk, whoever was conducting the interview, telling him, the door is open, you're free to go. You don't have to answer our questions. That's clear on the record. Even Mr. Tosh admits that. The only time that he was in custody when one of these occurred was when he was in jail on the bad check charges, and it was the follow-up interview, if you will, that they complained about when Lunsman went in after we received the nuclear DNA evidence that showed he was not the person whose pubic hairs were in the vaginal vault, okay? Lunsman went back in to conduct an exit interview because all of this information that they had just seemed so inconsistent with that nuclear result, and their concern was that they had always had this concern. There may have been more than one person involved in this. You know, one of the things that Mr. Johnson brought up was that Stephen Tosh kept proclaiming that I'm impotent. Well, the police didn't know that. They kept saying, is there any medical evidence of that? And he kept saying, no, but I take this drug and it makes me impotent. He never produced anything from a doctor saying, I'm impotent. But the fact that he kept saying he was impotent was one of the things that really bothered them, because what the doctor who, and this is in the record, what the doctor who examined this young girl said was, this wasn't necessarily done with a penis. This was potentially a hard object, you know, that was shoved into this girl. And that, you know, his protesting that I'm impotent, I couldn't have done that, really concerned the officers. Because there's a lot of this evidence that didn't get into the public. The public didn't know about some of the things that the police knew about, things that they held back because they were trying to catch the perpetrator.
Well, assuming that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in keeping out the purported expert, why, with 2 years before the trial, should he have been allowed to go seek another one?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, I would answer that by saying that this case had been going on for 4 years by that point already. We had had two amended scheduling orders, or three, I can't remember as I stand here. The trial judge, during one of those amended scheduling orders, had specifically said, we're not going back to square one. I'm going to amend this thing and allow you some additional time. I think it was with regard to his expert. But I'm not letting you go back, because he had served a whole set of fact discovery on me that was past the discovery deadline, and this case just kept dragging on. And so the court said specifically, we're not going back to square one. I'll give you some additional time. He names his expert. I depose his expert. His expert can't articulate a standard of care and gets bounced on the Daubert challenge. And with all due respect, I know there's no case law on this in South Dakota, but I do think that the rule clearly states for good cause shown. Now, if this court is going to conclude that ipso facto, if you get an expert bounced on a Daubert challenge, that you are entitled then to a continuance to go find yourself a new expert, then I think that's inconsistent with the notion of good cause, but that's what this court is going to have to say.
Well, if the trial was next week, I'd agree with you, but it hadn't even been set yet.
Well, I think, I can't recall, I think it had been set. I think there was a delay associated with Steve Pionk being in Iraq. And I think that he came back later than we thought he was going to, and it got pushed off to August. Now, I'm not going to disagree with Mr. Johnson if he says we didn't have a date certain. I know we had more than one date for this trial, and Mr. Pionk's being in Iraq was one of the reasons for the last delay. Until he got back, we couldn't have the trial. But Your Honor, all that's going to do is push back Daubert challenges, which are really motions in limine. I mean, that's really what it is. You know, I've seen case law that suggests Daubert motions can be made at trial. An expert's qualifications can be challenged at trial. and a motion can be made at trial that that expert's testimony be stricken as lacking foundation, because that's really what we're talking about. They're like any other witness. You know, you challenge their foundation by voir direing them at trial, and the next thing you know, the judge doesn't let them answer the question. I think all that's going to do is put you in a sandbag position as an attorney. You're going to want to hold off until the bitter end for fear that if you win, they're just going to get to go back to square one and go expert shopping. And the case that I cited, I know it's not a South Dakota case, but we don't have anything directly on point. I think the court's logic is very good. The court's logic is it's ridiculous to assume that a party is going to put something less than its best foot forward with its expert testimony. You know, what you're really saying is, okay, that one's not good enough. I'm going to go back and try to do better.
So you don't send in the B team and then hold the A team back.
But that's my point. If you're going to send in the B team, you better hope they can win the game, or at least you better hope they can get to the start of it.
Mr. Eve, though,
yes, sir.
You know, it looked to me, from what I read in the record, like the trial court based the decision solely on the fact that the prior scheduling order wasn't going to be changed with respect to this new trial date. And it didn't look to me like the trial judge looked at the 4, 5, 6 factors that we usually look at on continuances and delays. You know, prejudice to the party, were there dilatory tactics, the usual things that are always looked at. In fact, I think we have 6 or 7 factors. And it looked to me like this trial judge didn't look at any of those and relied exclusively on the fact that he had issued an order and this was going to be in violation of it. But yet, it was 18 months. That doesn't seem to me to make sense.
Well, all I can say is this, Justice Inner, this court has routinely indicated that it's going to give great discretion to trial judges when it comes to managing their calendars, when it comes to managing cases, when it comes to setting deadlines. The thing I'll say about what Judge Flemmer did in this case, he lived with this case a long time. This case was in front of him over and over and over again on motion after motion after motion. And in order, I understand what you're saying, but I think you can make that argument in virtually any case. And I think it goes back to what my response to the Chief Justice was with respect to what is the rule going to be. Because if this court is going to pronounce a rule that says if your expert is kicked out on a Daubert challenge before a trial date has been set, or if the trial date is far enough that a reasonable person would conclude that party may be able to go find a new expert and get them named and you can get them deposed before the trial actually occurs, then I think that's the rule that this court's going to have to announce. But frankly, I think it's a bad rule because I think it puts trial judges in a position of not getting to handle their schedules and not knowing. And frankly, I think it puts attorneys in a bad position, you know?
The trial court didn't rely on this Daubert expert rationale, though. Judge Flemmer didn't make his decision based on what I'll call form shopping,
right,
with respect to experts in Daubert.
Well, I think what Judge Flemmer did say was that the fact that your lone expert got bounced is not sufficient reason for me to reopen the scheduling order to let you go find another one. Because that was the whole basis for the request. I mean, if counsel gets sick, if a party gets sick, if things of that nature occur, I think you find that people are all willing to move stuff around and move it back. But this case has been going on for 4 years. And so he names another expert, okay? And we go through the trouble of deposing that expert. And I bring another challenge. And the court once again says, this one isn't any good either, you know? But we don't have a trial date set yet because maybe my client's in Iraq. Maybe we just haven't set the date yet. At that point, basically, if that rule is in place, he gets to go find another one. I mean, this goes on and on and on. This case was in federal court in 1998, or that was actually when the rape occurred. It was in federal court in 2001. So from federal court all the way through the point where that occurred, you have to presume that the plaintiff couldn't find an expert that would meet the standard. Now, Mr. Johnson says, I was flabbergasted that my expert's testimony was thrown out here, that my expert was thrown out. I wouldn't have been. If you'd have been at that deposition, you wouldn't have been. I mean, he couldn't articulate a standard. And when he did articulate one, he admitted it wasn't the standard that anybody else accepted. That's classic. I mean, that's a classic reason to challenge that person's credibility. And the final thing that he said, and I want to make this clear, I want to make sure the court understands this, when I asked him what it was, talk to me about the specific things that you've seen that my clients did that you're going to say to the jury were improper. He said, I'm not going to do that. The jury will know them when they see them. Well, if the jury's going to know them when they see them, why do we need him? What good is he going to do them? If his response is going to be, you'll know them when you see them. This man didn't even look at the videotapes. He didn't even watch them. He didn't watch the interrogations that were preserved on videotape, but he was willing to call them conduct becoming of a police state.
Last question on this, at least for me. What happened during the 18 months from the denial of the qualifications of the expert until the trial date?
You know, Your Honor, I'm trying to remember. I know that my client,
Well, let me put it this way. Was there active litigation going on, active discovery, or was the case just kind of sitting there for 18 months?
As I recall it, Your Honor, the scheduling order had run. Mr. Johnson's motion was denied. And the only reason for that significant delay, the majority of that 18 months was because Steve Pionk was in Iraq. And I think basically the court had made it clear this case is ready for trial. The fact that, you know, we're going to try it when Pionk's back, but I'm not going to let you guys continue to just batter each other over the head in the meantime. And I'm certainly not going to take it back to square one and start all over again. I think that's a fair assessment of it. Your Honor, I'm not going to get into a new topic at this point. I'm short on time. I've never been yelled at for sitting down early, so I'll do that. Thank you.
Nor have we ever yelled at anybody for sitting down early. Thank you, Mr. Heap. Mr. Johnson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
The question about the comments, as Justice Haber brought up, about killing himself are, in fact, a part of the record. Cite the page number of the trial transcript where you find it. I cite and attach a copy of the affidavit of Steve Tosh to my second reply brief. If you read all of that, there is evidence in this record that indicates those statements were made to him by these officers. The very first interview that was conducted by the chief of police, where Steve Tosh said he was told that he could always kill himself if he didn't like the surveillance. But lo and behold, that was the only interview or interrogation that wasn't taped. Everything else was taped beyond that.
Well, why didn't Mr. Tosh go into the chief's office? Didn't he seek the chief out?
Say that again, please.
Who made the contact in that interview? Did Tosh go looking for Schwab?
Tosh went in to complain about the surveillance.
Well, then how would Schwab know he was coming and have the video clips ready to roll?
I'm not sure how to answer that other than the fact that they always had it ready to roll any other time that he came in to be interviewed or interrogated by the officers. And they did, in fact, interrogate him to the extent that I have outlined in my brief, and those comments were, in fact, made.
Mr. Johnson, on these expert opinion, Mr. Heeb says that your expert actually said, watch the tapes, and I mean, except for the tape, the one interview that wasn't taped, but watch the rest of them. And if there was, they could see it by watching it. What do you say to that? Why do we need an expert to begin with? How much harm did that do your case not to have an expert testify? That if this is as egregious, it's kind of one of those things that you will see it. You will know it when you see it. So what prejudice did that, how did that affect your case?
The testimony of Dr. Game was important, especially when it comes to the surveillance, where he said that, as Attorney Heave has indicated, was similar to what you would find in the police state, to be followed around town like he was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for a month. That was just more than a person should have to tolerate. Now, the IIED claim has one of the requirements to show that that was extreme outrageous conduct. And Dr. Game said it was extreme and outrageous. In fact, he said if it was so bad that he was such a threat to the community of Aberdeen, and they admit that they had enough evidence to arrest him, why didn't they arrest him and put him in jail and forego the surveillance? Well, the reason for that is because then, once he's locked up, they'd have no further contact with him to do what they were trying to do, which in my opinion was to coerce a confession out of him. The trial judge, did allow the issue of IIED to go to trial on the statements that were made. He mentions that in the summary judgment motion, that if those statements are in fact made, he, as a matter of law, found that that in fact could be something that the jury could take and say it was improper and it was extreme. But the counterbalance of that was my ability to come in with an expert to counterbalance what their expert was saying, and he said there was no problem with that. That was all okay. Dr. Game said, you should read his testimony, what he was referring to as a standard. Is there a standard that you get to this point and you cross it and you know it? There is no such standard. What he said is maybe one question isn't enough to show extreme conduct, but a series of questions along these same lines over and over and over again did amount to extreme conduct, and he would not condone that. He did not say that he ignored the Imbaugh-Reed interrogation technique. He read it all. He knows about it. He even referred to it in his reports. He didn't try to come up with some new novel theory of how you do interrogations. That's simply not a part of that deposition testimony.
I understand that the officer, that Tosh went to a movie one afternoon, and the officer followed him into the movie. Did he sit next to him?
He did.
Did he do everything but eat out of his popcorn sack?
I can't answer that. I don't think so. But
anyway, was that tested? Was that videotaped?
That interview in the movie theater? No, that was not.
When the officers drilled through the taillight of Tosh's vehicle in order to follow him or easily, was that videotaped?
It was not, Judge.
Okay. Were both individuals involved in that?
They were. Both individual meaning Pionk and Lundman, yes.
Okay. Matter of fact, it was Pionk did the drilling, but it was the other guy's idea to do it, wasn't it?
It was just the reverse of that. Pionk got the idea of reading some kind of a police manual or book or something that condoned it. He gave that manual to Lundman. Lundman said, this is a good idea, let's go do it. They both went to do it, and Lundman is the one that pulled the trigger on the drill, but Pionk was standing by.
After your first reported expert was turned down by the trial court, did you go back to the trial court with another expert, or did you not even get that far because you've been shut down?
I did not go that far. Judge, you've got to remember, I have a client that is indigent. He's living off of welfare. This is a pro bono case for me to the extent that that makes any difference. But my expert that I had to buy was money I advanced into this case. To go out and buy another expert or have the retainer fee to do it simply was not plausible at that time. I wanted to be sure that I could contact the expert, who I could no doubt find, that had a police background, if that's the requirement, and then engage that expert after the judge told me that it was okay to do that. And we had 20 months between the denial of my motion to get another expert in until we actually went to trial. And there was very little activity, if any, in that whole period of time. We could have easily put this new expert in play, do the normal discovery work with his opinions, et cetera, and still had the Dahlberg challenge brought up far in advance of the trial date that wasn't set at the time that I filed my motion for the continuance of the trial. And you're right, Justice Zinser, the trial court did not consider the fact that my preparation of my case was caught off guard. The suggestion was made by defense counsel that to prevent this from happening in the future, you should have two experts. They suggested that in their trial brief to the trial court. I should have a standby. And my response to that is, if you don't think the first expert is good enough, why would you even hire him? But when you find out the trial judge doesn't think that he qualifies, then let's have time to do it with a new one. We have plenty of time in this case. And I can say from a practical standpoint, in my practice at least, from now on, if I have an expert that's going to be challenged, I'm going to see to it that that is a motion is brought up early in the case. So I will have time that should the trial court not think the same I think about my trial expert, I will have time to bring somebody else back in.
What happens if you're, what would happen if the your second expert is found to be unqualified too? What would you do then? Would you say, well, now I want to go out and find a third one or a fourth one? What test do we use to make sure the trial just don't go on forever? After all, it's our responsibility as judges to make sure these cases come through the system fairly expeditiously so people get their justice.
You're right, and I don't have an answer to that. I think it's a case-by-case approach that you have to take. Thank you, Judge. But in this the facts of this particular case are such that there was no harm done to this case whatsoever that would prejudice the defendants in this case to have more time provided for me to bring in my expert. And I will know, based on what the trial court was telling me I should look for, and that's to find an expert that had a police background, because in my opinion, that's what the trial judge did, is he threw out my expert because he hadn't been an officer in the past. And I don't think that's the sole criteria to determine if he's, in fact, an expert. I'd like to mention, just as a comment on the side, Justice Sinder brought up the normal considerations you have in a continuous for a case like this, for this issue to be brought up. I'm involved in another case where my expert in that case acquired cancer and in a very rapid fashion died 2 months before the trial in that case. And that just happened this year. I went back to the trial court in that case with that information, and the trial judge, Myron, indicated you get more time to bring in another expert. Because that's one of the considerations in the motion for a continuance of a trial date is if you have an absent witness. Well, I had an absent witness in my case with Tosh, and I should have been allowed to use that same rationale to bring in another expert because my expert died. And I should be able to bring back that very important information to the jury with a new expert that can, in fact, provide that. The standard that was brought up in the deposition by Attorney Heave is a standard that he was referencing when there was a cause of action in the complaint for negligent intentional infliction of emotional distress. That's the standard. To have a negligent violation, you have to have some kind of a standard, and that's what he was getting at when he was asking that question, and we didn't need to do that in this case. I see my time is up, so I'll sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.